This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or tieke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the tieke from total extinction.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today I'm talking with Alan Wise, who was a settler in the T&L farm block in the 1980s and became a foundation member of the Settlement Association and chairperson, among other roles in the settler group. I will be discussing with Alan what it was like being a farm settler in the late 20th century. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz, then going to podcast, then going to community or chaos. Alan, could you tell us a bit about, well, first, welcome to community or chaos, and then can you tell us a bit about why you wanted to become a sheep farmer and how did you end up as a farm settler in the hills above T&L?
Thank you, Marvin, and hello, listeners. Yes, I grew up in Cheviot, which is a farming district, and the main occupation was related to sheep farming in that area, and I ended up working on farms there and decided that I wanted to go further and get a diploma of agriculture at Lincoln, and aim to own my own farm. I tried several ways of getting a farm, leasing, share farming, all sorts of things I looked at. And in the end, I tried to get a ballot farm, which was a successful scheme that helped new farmers getting on land in new areas. I tried for the ballots over a 10-year period, in the end, I had applied to 31 ballots, and the last one was successful in 1979 at Southland. Also, there was 8 farms that year in that region, and we had about a 30% chance to be successful. So I drew my first choice, which was a Mossburn property near Tianao.
Can you tell us a bit more about the ballot system and the settler system? It started after World War One, didn't it?
Yes, it was to resettle farmers after the war and also develop quite extensive pastoral land to make it better farming. And the government invested a tremendous amount of money and regrassed, fenced, drained, whatever it needed to be, cleared bush to make these to be more intensive farming.
And what was it like applying for a ballot and then heading for T&L? That was fresh land and unfarmed at that point, wasn't it?
Yes, it was fairly raw, and if you'd seen it before they started to develop it, you would never think it would be suitable for farming. But over time, they did tremendous things there. I actually went to an interview with the Commissioner of Crown Lands and the Settlement Committee, and they questioned you, and if you were, they were satisfied you had the knowledge and ability, they put your name in the ballot, and it was quite hard to miss the ballot several times, but I kept trying to get the farm, and in the end, I was successful.
People, when they drive to Manapouri, pass that land, through that land, don't they, or close to it? On the way to Tianau on the way to Manapouri from Tianau, or Fjord land.
Yes, that's right. All that land was just in a raw place, and there's a small area called the Wilderness Area, which shows you what the original bush pine and everything was in the Manuka and so on was there. But they made a tremendous difference to the number of stock and the number of people, and it's a success story. And those young farmers were very keen to be successful and develop the land. And now it's a huge number of stock there and a great benefit to the whole community.
Wasn't that one of the things that made Tianau, the township, go ahead?
Yes, it did. It was a very quiet, sleepy town, especially in the wintertime, and there was only a small number of tourists that actually stayed there in those days. But they also had the Manapouri power scheme that was one of the boosts for the area.
So you were quite happy to get that particular piece of land, weren't you?
It was a good farm. It was pretty reasonably flat and had a peat swamp in the middle, and had done a lot. They'd done a lot of drainage. It was quite close to Mossburn. The farms were very good farms, but it required a lot of hard work. And originally there was only 17 paddocks and the biggest paddock was 130 acres. By the time I finished, there was 80 paddocks and a road through and all sorts of things.
And were you the only one in the area, or were there other people doing
yes.
the same
Yes, thing? I got the first Mount Hamilton farm settlement block, which was originally the manager's house, but right all around me were settlers, and every year they probably added a couple more farms there, and they were working up the valley, and so we all had a lot in common, and they came from all districts in New Zealand. So you actually had a competitive element there, and we all combined and supported each other. We were in a farm improvement club and so on like that. So we had a lot of discussion about farming. We learnt on the job and learnt what that particular area needed.
The settlers also were still connected with the settlement program, weren't they, when she saw? What was your relationship with the settlement program? What was it called, actually?
Originally it was the Lands and Survey administered the settlement scheme, and we had basically mortgaged to the Crown, and we had field officers come regularly to visit us because we originally only owned the letterbox and leased the land. So they had an interest to see that we were successful. And, and under the 1949 Land Act, the Crown set the rules for supporting settlers to be successful.
What kind of things did they do?
They could lower interest rates, they could wipe debt, they could support by extra cultivation or extra help to the settler to get established. So they were quite flexible. The Crown was a good landlord.
Did they give advice?
Yes, definitely.
All this happened during fairly interesting times because you were there during the changes under David Lange and Roger Douglas in bringing in neoliberalism and ending the social economic welfare state. How did these changes affect small farmers?
Yes, we went from Muldoonism, which was in, setting prices to and protecting farmers and encouraging development, to Roger Douglas that wiped the subsidies and a whole lot of incentives to, for land development and livestock improvement scheme and all sorts of things that the Muldoon had introduced to help boost farming. And, of course, at the same stage, the prices of our produce dropped when New Zealand was left out in the cold from the UK joining the EEC. So we had to adapt to a whole lot of pressures of the changing world.
Yeah, what were some of those pressures?
The first one's financial, because you've got to pay your bills, and effectively farm prices dropped and interest rates skyrocketed, and that was a pretty bitter pill to take.
Well, what were the SMPs?
Supplementary minimum payment. So the government guaranteed the price of wool and price of meat, and if it didn't meet that, they topped it up from the taxpayers' funds.
Now, they cut that at the same time as joining the European Economic Union. So you lost a market. And you also lost the SMPs about the same time.
Yes, there was a whole lot of things that happened at the same time. I mean, I think that the situation was artificially setting prices and development and so on was unsustainable. We had to have a correction. But, however, the correction was pretty severe, and the changes with Roger Douglas were thick and fast.
Could they have happened in a slower pace?
Yes.
So also, if it happened in a slower pace, you could look at things and see if they're working.
Yes, it would have helped. But farmers were very adaptable. They changed their way to farm. They changed their inputs. They also, effectively, in the end of the day, they were called a sunset industry. But in the end, we actually had to get them out of the trouble, and farming really rescued the economy that after those huge disruptions.
Do you think it was a mistake to come to depend on one industry?
Well, we still do that. We depend on China, for instance, as one market. So, farmers choose to use their land whichever way they think they'll be the best profit and sustain them. So, we adapt to the signals that we get.
Is the settlement program still going?
No. It's suspended in 1985 because it wasn't economic to settle them with the high interest rates and the high cost of land, and the equation didn't actually work. So, and the trouble was that the existing settlers were feeling the blowtorch as well, because they were struggling to deal with the changes that occurred and the economics of the day.
How would, if you'd have been finance minister, how would you have done things differently?
I think that some of it was right, and in fact we in New Zealand are now subsidy-free, and other countries in the world still have artificial subsidies and supports, and it's more efficient if the market picks the country or the place that grows the thing the most economic cost. So free market, we went to free market, and so that gives you the signals that you're trying to be efficient and to be the best producer and the more efficient producer in the world market. So it equips us to handle today's conditions in the world.
In the scheme itself, there were some changes before that was disbanded, weren't there?
Yes. The Royal Bank did a rescue system for discounting mortgages and restructuring, and the settlers were demanding that they had some sort of help that way, and the Land Act specifically offered that, but Land Court actually didn't, were reluctant to do that and go down that track. But in the end, through the settlers fighting it and organising themselves into an organisation, they put political pressure. And also we used Federated Farmers help, and I was the chairman of the Mossburn branch of Federated Farmers and also involved in the Southland Federated Farmers. So we actually got help from the main organisation in the country. And so we combined with other areas that were also having this problem, Taupo, Northland, the Central Plateau was it called, and also other areas that were actually sort of at high risk too. So they wanted some sort of reprieve.
Did you form a committee?
Yes, we formed a committee. Originally, it was the Mossburn and Tianau branches of Federated Farmers, and we were on a mission because it was all our members were basically involved. But we went out further than that, as I said, to national areas and got a lot of help from a whole lot of people who were knowledgeable. Also, I was involved in the South Island Leaseholders Council, which was actually a very, very good organisation from Timaru that dealt with Crown renewable leases and pastoral leases and all sorts of Crown instruments. And they were very, very helpful to guide me how to deal with those issues.
When people want to go farming now, can you do it if you have a small income and you don't inherit land? Or
very hard now. It used to be if you were a rabbitee, you used your money to get rabbits to get land, and then after all, the woods there was shearing. You were sure for. And you were a good sharer, you saved the money, and often people helped to get you established. But it's harder. The sums involved now and the value of the land is huge. So it is a very, very difficult job for a family farm. It lends itself to corporate farming rather than an individual.
Isn't that a bit of a shame, really? I mean, many people that grew up around farms who dream of owning their own farm.
Yes, it is a problem. And also the age of farmers is getting older. So we have to have a succession to enable new people with the new technology and higher education to get on the land to do new things.
Do you think there should be some scheme like the one you had in the prior to the 80s to help people get onto land?
Yes, we could. The Royal Bank had a 85% loan, and also, as I said, with the ballot, you were settled with special terms and so on. The government still owned 10% of New Zealand's farmland, so they still got that farm bank there available. But at the moment, they're just corporate farming and using their economy as a scale to deal with and the strength that they've got from that marketing and so on to farm successfully.
Couldn't they somehow have the advantages of when selling the product and so on and adding value and promoting it? Couldn't that be something that both the corporations and the government did, but still allow people to start on a small scale to own and farm land? I mean, are small farms, can't they be just as productive per acre?
Yes, they are. And there are schemes to have profit sharing and get young people having a financial commitment. And dairy farms, they, of course, have the share milking pathway to farm ownership, and you move from a 10% or a contract milker to up to a 30% and then a 50% share in the enterprise. So there are ways, and also sometimes farmers try to get their children and other people to help. And a lot of people get help from a relative or family member to actually get a start.
Mm-hmm. Is there still any kind of government program like there was to get people on the land? Or
the short answer is no. No.
Do you think it's a mistake?
Well, it's a world trend to get bigger and more corporate and less family farms. And I mean, a lot of family farms in America and other countries are struggling. So possibly it's not the environment that make that happen at the moment.
Well, I'm sure that's actually the case, that many farms, a lot of dairy farms in America used to be family farms, especially in the Midwest, but even in California. And there are hardly any family farms left. They're mostly corporate farms owned by Monsanto and company. But it's good for the corporations. I wonder if it's the best thing for the people who actually work in farming, and also, is it always the best thing for the land?
Yeah, I don't think it is. And monoculture is not a good idea. When you go to some of these farms in America, the huge areas of the same corn crop or whatever, they used to sustain many families and people on that land, and you end up with towns dying and a whole rural depopulation, which is not a good thing. And I still think that, like France and other countries, you actually need to recognise the custodians of the land. And some of it's aesthetic value, some of it's sustainable and to look after the land and the treasures of it, like the forest and the birds and the whole picture, rather than just agriculture.
Yeah, I'm going to play a piece of music now and then we'll come back. Well, friends, we're talking with Alan Wise about farming and starting a farm under the older settlers program, but also farming now. And you just heard a song by Malcolm Gordon from the album The Cobbler's Grandson, and it was about farming in New Zealand, I think. So, Alan, could you tell us how you feel about the prevalence of dairy farms over sheep farms?
First of all, I'm very sad that the sheep farm has declined from 80 million sheep to 20 million. And when I first went farming, the wool was the number one income on my farm. And it's a very sad day that wool has gone down to the stage where it is. And sheep farming has declined, but part of it is being used for housing, development, forestry. A whole lot of land has been taken from, and also for use for dairying. So a whole lot of land that was previously sheep farming is gone. The dairying is very... is more pollutant and needs to be carefully managed, and also there's not all land is suitable for dairying. But dairying model has been very efficient. It has so many different aspects and all different products they produce. They're not commodity takers like the sheep and the meat and wool had ended up as, and that was fought with, and there was a political preference to be the free market when I was involved in arguing with these ideas, and we pushed to try and get a dairy model with cooperative type system, but the free market forces won on that day, as I said, the farmers are also have the choice what they farm, and it's set by economics and just things that they have to make their choices on.
How much choice do you have if you start a farm? Because if you borrow money, say from bank or some other source, they want you to pay it back interest rates. And at the start, you can probably make more money quickly from a dairy farm than starting a sheep farm.
Yeah, but a dairy farm conversion is quite expensive to do. It takes risks, and you have to have the skills to do it.
But are the banks and lenders more likely to lend money for dairy farms?
Well, at one stage, the banks were very encouraging to convert to dairying because it seemed to be more profitable, and they could lend large sums of money. So that enhanced their business portfolio too.
Well, that would be one reason for going into dairy. I mean, you probably have to, if you're going to borrow money, you have to do what you can to get people to accept your, to give you a loan. So you have to listen to what the banks say.
Yes, well, of course, going dairying stacked it, and many farmers made that choice and have been very successful about it.
The land use is an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, one of the things that I think with climate change, land will be more valuable. And also transport may be more difficult. So we may have to use more of our, produce more of our food in New Zealand than we used to.
Yes, we may have to change the whole equation again to go local and produce our own food. But sadly, that's not happening. I mean, Hawaii had a strong pineapple industry, and it's now sort of land's just vacant because they've gone away because it's cheaper to buy it from another country to produce it themselves, and it doesn't seem to matter now that you need to pay for overseas funds to buy things, commodities from other countries, whereas in the old days we produced it ourselves.
Isn't there a certain security in being able to produce your own food?
Yes.
I know in Japan the government's quite keen on being able to produce and try to produce enough rice so that they don't have to buy rice overseas.
Yes, that's right. And China, again, is looking at the future of food, the sustainability for their population. So they're trying to join the food train right from beginning to end, trying to control the market and the produce that they need. So, food is still a very important part of the equation.
Do you think when land use should keep agriculture in its frame of how we look at the use of land? I mean, once you build a subdivision in an Outram or Mosgiel, you're not going to be able to use it as horticultural land anymore.
We need to to have safeguards to prevent special soils and good farmland being lost for housing and forestry and other areas. I personally am against selling good farmland to forestry. It causes rural depopulation, and trees actually, despite that, they have a place on hill country and riparian plantings and stop erosion. It's necessary, but I feel sad to see the good farmlands being taken to forestry.
What do you think we should do about it?
Well, they are turning down some of the forestry, for instance, near Lawrence and so on. But in some ways, we need to recognise those forces that are driving people to put trees in. It's partly the carbon credits they get and the need for timber in the world. There's less and less natural forests left.
One of the interesting things is that sometimes countries do carbon credits because they don't want to spend the energy and effort for non-carbon energy, like a railway or a bus system. You'll save a lot more carbon that way. In the long run, you're in a better position if you build infrastructure to get non-carbon energy for you.
Yes, I think that's actually the carbon credit system and the other things like charges on coal and things. It actually has a lot of flaws in it, it's not necessarily, sometimes we're kidding ourselves because it's actually a false premise that the calculation is being done. One of the things I was concerned about was that the farmers don't often get the actual credits. The government get the credits. So we're not actually rewarding the people who actually do the change.
Yeah. What do you think about to some extent, rural areas have been depopulated, at least from permanent residents, haven't they? Schools and banks and so on are closed.
Yes, that's a tragedy. And, I mean, in modern day life, rural people need the same services that their town cousins have. And having no midwives in the central Otago area and things like that is a big problem. So We need to have those facilities available, and encourage people to have all those services, and certainly end up with closing schools and all sorts of things, that so that it's not sustainable.
Some ways have some rural sectors really haven't recovered from the 1980s, when the rural sections really started to get closing banks and other and healthcare and so on. You lost. They really haven't come back, have they?
No.
I was quite disappointed when I read that some of the forestry mills in central North Island were closing because of the cost of electricity. That seemed to me that was a backward step, really.
Yes, yeah, so of course there's new solar farms and all sorts of things coming in now, but the retrograde steps that were caused by the 80s changes, a whole lot of areas lost their soul, basically, and it was a very sad thing to happen. I think we need to look more closely at encouraging people as farmers, as custodians of the land, and encourage them to look after the land. And obviously a lot of countries do that.
You need to have to look after the whole rural community. Like if you're not going to want to live there and with your family, if you can't get medical services and you can't send your kids to school.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly the issue that we're facing today. And you're going sort of miles and miles to go to town, and that's not sustainable either. Cost of fuel today.
Some of these things really have to be led by the government, don't they?
Yes, I think the government has to have a role in that, and to help provide, for instance, medical services in rural areas, education. And you've got to have the infrastructure in those rural areas to help. One time a tourist walked into my house in Mospentiano Road, and they thought they were going to die on the side of the road because they hadn't seen anybody for 10 kilometres, and it was a cold day, and I was shocked that they thought it was the end of the world, but effectively it was just their judgment of where they were. We gave them a nice bowl of hot soup and took them down to the nearest village and helped them to get on a bus or whatever, they were fine. But they looked at that as just about the end of the world.
Well, people aren't used to the open spaces that we still have.
Yes, yes, that's right. And I mean, that's a special thing too.
Do you think that we should have work harder at adding value to our products, whether it's wool or trees? We send whole trees overseas instead of making them into furniture and sending the tables and chairs overseas. We send logs overseas.
Yes, I think that's a very important issue. We're sending mainly raw products and commodity things rather than increasing value and helping our own economy. And producing more jobs and so on. Also, if the product is versatile and has a high value, then it's less susceptible for market risks and you have more control of your products. But against that, if you increase value, you increase costs, and obviously those costs have to be viable.
Do you think there should have been more research done and more taxpayer-funded research for instance, adding value to wool?
Yes, I'm actually passionate about wool. I worked in a woolen mill and saw all the products that they produced. The wool industry was the best in the world. And we marketed it well. We had a wool board and research and development. Now we don't even further process wool. So effectively, we've lost the plot, and it's a sad day.
You think there are some times when the government, they say the government should never make choices or try to pick winners, but sometimes the government needs to encourage winners. I mean, Scandinavia would have never been where they are now, Finland, if the government, for instance, who have no more resources than New Zealand. They have timber, they have lakes, but they don't have oil, they don't have coal or heavy industry. Yet they've managed to produce one of the most efficient education systems and a really well-run society because the government's been willing to work with the communities to
And investing in society is a very important thing that governments should do, but effectively some things I worry about political decision making there's a sort of a hidden agenda, et cetera, but, and also they're too far removed from the raw face of what's actually happening. So centralized decision making is not necessarily a good decision thing either.
Yeah. Well, how about, do you think local bodies should have more input?
Yeah, I think local bodies is good. They've sort of been diverted from the plot a wee bit by central government pushing all sorts of extra things onto local government. But it's democracy working. You're accountable. You can ring your local councillor and give them a chew if you're not happy about something. It's right close. The decision making is right close in your own district, and specific to your own problems and issues.
Do you think there's a future for wool in spite of the mistakes we've made? Or maybe there's a future for wool, but is there a future for wool in New Zealand? I mean, to me, in some ways, it was a mistake. To go so the plastic industry is based on two things. First, they're based on oil. You make plastic, and if people stop using oil, which we need to stop, well, then the main input into plastic is gone. I mean, there are other ways of making plastic, but most cheap plastic is made from oil or oil products or.
Yeah, we call them synthetics, and they were very good at their job, and they made whatever product you needed, whatever thickness you needed, and did it very well and at a cheaper price. And so that was why the wool industry struggled to compete there. But as you say, we're now moving away from carbon fuel and oil. And if the usage drops, the byproducts drop too. So I think there'll be a change there.
Also, most plastics end up in the ocean, which if you like to eat fish, is not a great thing. Or if you value, I mean, the ocean in some ways is even more important to the Earth's future than land.
Yes, it's a frightening prospect plastic is getting into every facet of life.
There are plenty of reasons for using less plastic, and wool can actually do a better job for many things than plastic.
Yeah. Well, there's good substitutes from a plastic bag or in having a nice jute knitted one or a wool one. And we are now looking at alternatives, and they're actually good alternatives. Even shoes are made from wool. And so I think the drive is on to find new products.
Do you think that there should be a research in New Zealand for wool?
Yes, if we're going to drive those changes, we need to start at home, and we're doing that with a whole lot of things that in sustainable land management, climate change, all sorts of things. We actually have to deal with it in our own home, in our own country, and set an example. And so we still produce a lot of wool that we need to find a value for. At the moment, the sheep farmer is actually losing money to harvest his wool.
You can, for instance, my house is insulated by wool. And it does a great job. And I'm sure there are many other places where we could use wool if we just made the effort and did the research. And so I'm sure it would cost money in the beginning, but it might pay off in the long run.
Well, in Country Calendar, you see a tremendous innovation of the rural people doing new ideas and new changes and new wool initiatives. So I think the gem is there to do it.
Do they need finance to help with that?
I think Catalyst money is helpful. As long as it is just at a certain stage, and then later on it would have to stand on its own feet.
I mean, once you get you start selling a product, you have to. Has to pay for itself eventually, or it won't remain being sold.
Yeah, well, we had a wonderful organisation called RONS, Wool Research Organisation, and it had a huge experimental work that they did at near Lincoln, and they also dealt with industrial problems that were facing processing and so on. So they were involved in the whole process of wool, and a wonderful team, but effectively, slowly, they lost their position because the farmers voted against the levy, and it was a protest vote because they were getting poor wool prices, and also they removed the wool board, which was totally involved in marketing and the benefits of wool.
Well, it seems kind of counterproductive. The price of wool is going down. You'd want to do the opposite. It seems to me you'd want to do more research and more added value and more promotion.
I feel that, but the feeling at the time was that they basically voted with their feet, and they actually helped the demise of the wool industry.
Do you think it was partly the times that everybody was talking about the free market would take care of everything, and maybe this kind of research and so on was not really valued?
Yes, I think all those things have sort of the flavour of the day, and enough people say it, and the rest of them sort of follow suit. And this has happened a lot, and the climate change is one of those changes that, over time, people have accepted it and are starting to deal with it in their own quarters. The argument was about free market, and we lost that battle.
How do you see the future of farming in New Zealand, agriculture?
I think it's good. Farming succeeds by good rainfall, good environment, good soils, people working on the land, and we've got all that. Farming was successful because it only cost about 10 cents to make a dollar. So, and the imports were coming naturally from the nature. So, farming was the perfect example of how to deal with things.
Well, Alan, thanks a lot for coming on board, and we've enjoyed talking with you. And there's a lot to think about on how we have a sustainable, both economically and environmentally, agriculture in New Zealand. There's a lot of things to think about yet.
Yes, there is. And I think we have hope with the new people coming in that they will find a solution to the problems.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.